This is the BBC.
This podcast is supported by advertising outside the UK.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Everyone knows therapy is great for solving problems, but getting therapy has its own problems too, like finding the right therapist, fitting into their schedule, and of course, the cost. Well, BetterHelp can solve those problems. It's totally online and built around your schedule. It's surprisingly affordable too. Connect with a credentialed therapist by phone, video, or online chat, all from the comfort of your home. Visit BetterHelp.com to learn more and save 10% on your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.
BBC Sounds, music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Anita Rani, and welcome to Woman's Hour from BBC Radio 4. Good morning, and welcome to Friday's Woman's Hour. Today's programme comes with a trigger warning. We're going to be talking about getting your children to do chores and whether or not you should pay them to do them. So what goes on in your household? Let me know, and please don't hold back. Not that you do. Do your children do the housework expected of them, or do you have to pay them to make sure they have a motivation? Or are you happy to just do everything for your kids and have no expectations of them whatsoever because it's just easier for you to do it all by yourself, less hassle? I ask because a journalist in The Times wrote about paying her son £40 a month to load the dishwasher. She does explain it's also his pocket money. What do you think about that? What was your experience? Should children be paid to do basic household chores? Is it teaching them a work ethic, or is it just a privilege that not everyone can afford? And even if you can afford it, shouldn't doing basic things like cleaning be a life skill? I cannot wait to open this can of worms. You can get in touch in the usual way. The text number is 84844. You can also message me via social media. It's at BBC Woman's Hour. You can also WhatsApp me or voice note me using the number 03700 100 444. And if you fancy sending me an email, because you've got a lot to say on the subject, then you can email me by going to our website. Also, if you're unsure about what to do and need advice, get your questions in, because I'm going to be speaking to a parenting coach and a psychologist. In fact, we've had a message in from Janet already on this. She says, I'm from a family of seven. We all received pocket money. We all had jobs to do, make your own bed, set or clear the table, wash up, etc. The money wasn't related to the jobs. We understood our mother was not a maid and we had to pull our weight for the money, though. Interesting, isn't it? I have to say that as an Asian kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, paying your children just wasn't part of the Asian parenting manual. Just putting that out there. Lots of you may be able to relate to that. Also on the programme today, a brand new series called Domino Day is starting on BBC Three. It's about witches and modern day dating. The brilliant writer Lauren Sequeira will be here to tell me all about it. And you are in for a treat. Music from the sublime classical singer Julia Bullock. Your text messages welcome on household chores and whether you should pay your children, or indeed anything you hear on the programme. Your thoughts, opinions, always welcome. 84844 is the number to text. But first, false beliefs and misconceptions about what does or doesn't constitute rape are more common than we might think. That's according to research published today by the Crown Prosecution Service, which also found that younger people between the ages of 18 and 24 hold more false beliefs about rape than those over 65. So what do these misconceptions mean for victims of rape? A huge percentage of which, as we know, are women. How can we make sure those misconceptions are stamped out? Well, joining me to discuss this are Baljit Ubey, Director of Strategy and Policy at the CPS, and Andrea Simon, Director of End Violence Against Women. Welcome to both of you. Thank you for coming in to talk about this. Baljit, I'm going to come to you first. Let's get into it. Tell us about the research. Why did you commission it?
Well, we commissioned this research because it was part of our rape strategy that we launched in 2020, where we said we want to do better in how we prosecute these cases. And part of that is looking at what is the public understanding of rape. We know that in the past there have been lots of harmful assumptions and misconceptions. And what we did was we revised our legal guidance some time ago to reflect that. But we thought it was important that we understood what people think now, because what that can help us do is think about how we charge cases, our trial strategy. So it's a part of our overall response to improve our, you know, prosecutions in rape cases.
So how was the research carried out and who did you speak to?
Well, it's a fairly rigorous piece of research. There was a discourse analysis. There was a literature review. There was a survey of 3,000 people, and there were focus groups and interviews. And this research was carried out by external experts in the field and academics. And as you say, some of the findings are troubling.
Well, we will talk about those in a moment, but just there's such a range of beliefs held about rape. How did you decide which ones to test, what questions to ask?
Well, we worked with experts in the field, groups like Andrea's, who really know, who talk to rape victims, who have that understanding. They also informed the work we did, looking at what the current harmful misconceptions are, especially in a world where there's social media now. Things have changed so much. So we got insights from experts to inform that work.
So what were the findings?
So the findings, as you said...
I mean, there's so many, so we'll pick some highlights.
Well, highlights, first of all, as you say, the 18 to 24 category, their understanding was less in terms of the accurate facts. And so just to give you a couple of highlights, young people were far less likely to understand that if a person says online that they want to meet up and have sex, that doesn't mean that they have to have sex when they meet. Young people were also far less likely to correctly identify that being in a relationship or marriage does not mean you always can assume consent. And less than half recognised that if someone had been drinking or taking drugs, a man is still capable of committing rape. So, as I say, some worrying findings.
Yeah, there's lots of others, but let's stick with the age difference, because I think a misconception of society is that young people are a lot more clued up and know what's right and what's wrong. What do you think about this, Andrea? What's happening? Why are young people more likely to have these misconceptions?
Well, yeah, it's a very interesting question. And the research, I mean, it brings a lot of reflections on, in some ways, that the public's understanding of rape and the reality of it has become more accurate, but that there's still huge misconceptions. And as you say, with younger people, I think one of the things that is obviously fueling younger people's understanding of sexual consent is the rapid rise of unchecked online misogyny. So many people are living their lives online now. Young people are exposed to a lot of content that is maybe sympathetic to perpetrators and is really emphasising this long-standing rape myth around women and girls having made up allegations of rape, which is not the case. That's actually really rare, but it's very clear that that's still something that's holding fast for younger people.
Baljit, were you alarmed by that finding that young people are more likely to have these misconceptions than the older generation?
I think we were surprised at that finding. It's not what we were expecting. And I think what Andrea says is absolutely spot on. It was outside the scope of this research to look at why young people had those views. But one of the focus groups did allude to the fact that social media, prevalence of pornography may be having an impact on those views.
It's worrying, isn't it? Because it means that there's a lot of work to do. It's not just about educating a generation that's, you know, come and gone. It's worse for the younger generation.
I think that's what makes this research really relevant, that the jurors of today and tomorrow, we need to do some education on this.
The other thing that you just mentioned there, Andrea, is that women are not believed. And I think one thing that's jumped out at me was only a third of respondents, and this is all your respondents, correctly identified that women rarely make up rape allegations. 36% got that right. Andrea?
Yeah. I mean, that misconception is obviously very prevalent. And what it speaks to is really the focus on the credibility and reliability, particularly of women who've been raped and when they come forward. And we know it's an issue across society. It will be an issue for victims going through the criminal justice system as well, because those views will also be found amongst police, amongst prosecutors, in juries, in court. So we're still, I think, grappling with rape cases often being built around perceptions of credibility of victims' accounts, and often a stranger rape scenario, which isn't the reality, because the vast majority of rapes, 1 in 3, actually take place within a domestic abuse context, so with a former or current partner. And I think we've spoken to women who, when they have been raped and they've reported it, but they've previously had consensual sex with a partner, when that's come to light, because the police have looked through their phone records, they've seen messages about that consensual experience, that they are less inclined to continue those cases. So we've seen cases dropped, even though there's other evidence of injuries, etc., that have been sustained, and they hold up the victim's account.
So, Baljit, but that's not an issue with public misconception. That's an issue with the system.
And that's why this research is really important. And we're going to share it with our partners, you know, across the system, policing. We've been doing a lot of work with the police to make sure that we are taking much more of a suspect-centric approach when we prosecute these cases. And what that means is, rather than focusing on the victim's credibility, we look at what the perpetrator is doing, you know, and really getting it out there that, you know, few rapists use physical force. Many manipulate and coerce victims. Many plan these, this, and it's not the first time they've done it. So some of the work that we've done jointly with the police through a programme called Operation Soteria has really highlighted that. And what we're absolutely committed to is that our prosecutors, working really closely with the police, are absolutely identifying these harmful assumptions and making sure that when we're looking at charging strategy, when we're looking at trial strategy, we are reframing those with accurate messages.
And looking at presumably what's going on within the CPS as well, and misconceptions held within your own system.
Absolutely. We're not complacent. I mean, we're proud of the work that we have done. You know, since we launched our strategy in 2020, we published our latest data. The number of cases coming through from the police have more than doubled.
Yeah.
The number of cases we're charging have more than doubled. The volume of convictions has tripled. But we recognise that the number of cases are a drop in the ocean when you look at reports. And we also know that not everybody reports.
Yeah.
So there's no room for complacency. But I do want to, you know, highlight how hard we're working on this to do better.
Because like you say, they are a drop in the ocean, because it's only what, 4 to 5% of reported rape cases end in a charge. And that's when you know that the vast majority of women are not lying. So there is something is absolutely failing women in the system.
That's right.
And it's much more than the misconceptions and mistruths within society.
Mm. And that's why, you know, our message is, you know, if you have been raped, please do come forward. The police want to take this really seriously. We want to take this really seriously. And we want to build really strong cases. And we want to improve.
I mean, you work on the front line, you speak to women all the time. What do you make of the results and the findings, and what this may do?
So I think, well, Badger's right, there's been a slight increase in prosecutions, but it's still a long way from where we need to be. It's still only around 5% of cases. And we've also seen other things going on. So there's an increase in victims actually pulling away and not supporting the cases. And one of the factors may well be timeliness. The length of time it takes for the CPS to make a charging decision has gone up. And then we've got a Crown Court backlog, and we see rape cases being stuck in the system for years, can be can be 4 years now. So it's very hard for victims to stay engaged when that's the context. It's important research, but we do need to see what the CPS are going to do with it.
They're sitting next to you. Yes. Just ask them.
Is it really going to change the way prosecutors make charging decisions? Is it going to change the type of advice that you give police? And training is welcome, but we have to see evidence of those wider shifts in the culture, like you say, towards investigating suspects, not focusing only on victims' credibility. And as well as that, we know it isn't just a CJS issue, because we have to see other things happening as well. How do we educate young people? What is in our relationships and sex education? Is it relevant to the kinds of attitudes that we're picking up on?
Absolutely, which is why the CPS have done this research, to shine a light on these held attitudes within society. And of course, we know society needs to change on every single level.
Yeah.
However, ask your questions directly to CPS about what you can actually do as a body, as a very important body.
Absolutely. We recognise that we play a really critical role in this, and we take this very seriously. I think what's positive about this research is the second part. The first part was about let's understand what the public think and let's look at that in a variety of different demographics. But the second bit is how can you reframe this so you can actually shift people's attitudes? And I think that's really, really interesting, because what this research has showed is that if you reframe those messages and you link those to values, that actually shifted the perceptions of some of the survey respondents. So to give you an example, if you reframe something, being raped can destroy a victim's world, taking away their freedom, trust and safety for the rest of their life. That shifted some of the attitudes. So what I'm really excited about is how we reframe these messages. And, you know, it's simple. You know, messages like few rapists use physical force and many manipulate and coerce victims. If we're thinking about that when we're working with the police, and one of the reasons why there's a bit of delay in the charging is one of the step change things that we have done is give early advice to the police. Get in there early. So that means the case may need more work before we make a final decision. But if we're thinking about how are we going to positively reframe rape truths, then we can get the case on the right track at the beginning, and then making sure that that really follows through, so that when we give instructions to advocates, that they're thinking about this when they're opening a case in court, when they're closing it, they're talking about that, so that they can say things like, everybody responds differently to the trauma of rape. Victims may not recognise it's rape straight away. Sure. And these are some of the things, these are the accurate messages are what we need to get out there and make sure they're informing our casework decision making.
Andrea.
Yeah, absolutely. I agree. You need to make sure that these rape myths are not influencing the cases that get charged and they go through the system. Unfortunately, we often see there is evidence where cases are dropped because of things that come to light which are about victim credibility. One example of that is therapy notes and the intrusive requests for victims counselling and therapy notes. And if there is information in there, it's often completely irrelevant to the case at hand, but if it can be used as evidence to discredit that victim. And we still see cases being dropped if victims don't want to share, don't give their consent for that information to be shared, but also for things that are found within that evidence that it don't relate to the case.
Because it's an incredibly, as you know, because you work with women all the time who go through this, that after having an incredibly traumatic experience of the assault, then having to prove your credibility, the onus is on the victim to then prove their credibility. That doesn't really compute, does it, Baljeet?
Absolutely. And we recognise those concerns. We are really, really clear, if it's not relevant, we should not be disclosing that. And we've worked really hard, and actually we've worked with specialist organisations to do podcasts for police officers and prosecutors about, we call it third party material, and when we should be asking for it. If it's not relevant, we should not be using it.
We do think that we need stronger protections on this, and there is a Victims and Prisoners Bill going through Parliament at the moment, and an amendment which would make it a judge decision as to whether those therapy and counselling notes can be disclosed. And we think that would work better for victims, because the practice on the ground doesn't always match up with the guidance that the CPS have issued and the training that officers get as well.
Well, it's been really interesting to speak to both of you. The research is out there, and someone has just been in touch to say the main reason that prosecutions are dropped when the victim has had a previous consensual sex with the perpetrator is that they know the juries are less likely to acquit in those circumstances. Prosecutors are very aware of the already high acquittal rates in rape cases and therefore not willing to pursue cases that will make those statistics even worse. Nobody's given the name. They've just messaged in with that. Thank you both for coming in to speak to me, Baljeet Ubay, Director of Strategy and Policy at the CPS, and Andrea Simon, from the Director of End Violence Against Women.
It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number smart beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. JD Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 50% on the Sleep Number limited edition smart bed for a limited time. For JD Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at a Sleep Number store or sleepnumber.com.
Women. 84844 is the number to text. Lots of you getting in touch about chores in your household and how you get your children to do them. Beverly says, at the age of 12, my mother became severely disabled and my twin sister and I were expected to take over all household chores. We had to cook, clean, do the laundry as well, and the obvious chores such as bed making and washing up. We were not paid for this and felt unfairly burdened, as we still had the expectation to achieve at school, so we felt we had very little time to be normal teenagers. Consequently, when I had my own children, I went too far the other way and asked very little of them. On balance, I think children should be expected to do some household chores, especially nowadays when both parents are usually working, but I think it should be tied to their pocket money. Your thoughts, and everyone has a thought, whether you have children or not. On to my next guest. Julia Bullock is an American classical singer who, according to Opera News, communicates intense, authentic feeling as if she was singing right from her soul. Well, last year, her debut solo album, Walking in the Dark, was nominated for a Grammy. Well, next week, Julia is bringing her mixed media project, History's Persistent Voice, to London's Queen Elizabeth Hall, shining a light on the words, work and experiences of Black American and British artists. She's also commissioned songs from leading Black women composers, including Cassie Kinoshi. And Julia joins me now. Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm honoured.
We are honoured. Tell me about the project, History's Persistent Voices. Let's talk about why you're coming to our wonderful city.
Well, I'm the artist in residence with the Philharmonia Orchestra this year, and they asked which projects that I've originated I wanted to bring and that they could also help to present. And this has been a project that really started almost 6-7 years ago now, with research that I was doing with another composer, Jesse Montgomery, American composer. And we went through this anthology that was released just after the Civil War, where a group of musicologists traveled all around to newly freed communities and transcribed 136 songs that dealt with resistance, rebellion. Some of the songs are about labor and grief, of course, and the trauma of enslavement. But really, it was the assertion of life that was so moving for Jesse and I. And we wanted to contribute to the already existing canon of Black American spirituals. So that's was one element of this kind of the inspiration for this project. Mm. But at the same time, while I was looking through this anthology, I was reading a lot of articles and watching various documentaries on the connections between enslavement in the U.S. And it's the lineage of oppression. Sorry, it's weird to put it that way, but it's the links between enslavement, convict leasing, sharecropping, Jim Crow, and then mass incarceration in the United States. And I also was reading this book by civil rights American lawyer Brian Stevenson and his work with the Equal Justice Initiative. And but in his book, if anyone who's listening to the Women's Hour does not either know this book or does not know of the Equal Justice Initiative, I know this is a British program, but some of the work that they're doing is really extraordinary.
We love a recommendation, especially a book recommendation. So bring it on. The Equal Justice Initiative. Yes, tell us.
Yes. Anyway, so in this book of Brian's, Just Mercy, he published some letters and poetry by his clients who had been incarcerated since they were children. They were given life sentences. And the language that these young children who were incarcerated were using was so similar to all of the messaging and the metaphors that was also utilized in the poetry from these songs by people who were enslaved. Mm. And so anyway, one last piece in terms of the inspiration for this project, at the time when, again, I was going through all of the source material, I was invited to be the artist in residence at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York City. It was my first artist residency ever. And I told them that I wanted to commission 21st century songs about liberation. And they shared with me that there was going to be an exhibition going on that season featuring artists from the southeastern United States.
Yeah.
And these artists who lived through the years of Jim Crow and sharecropping and whose ancestors were enslaved, their work was so explicitly addressing those issues. And there were these amazing transcribed interviews that were given. And again, reading through that language, it just reminded me of the generations before. It echoed all of the material of the prison, the young people who had been incarcerated. So all of the source material was given to composers,
black women. Yep.
That's right. And who's kind of building the repertoire for this entire project.
I mean, my arm hairs have stood up whilst you're explaining where the inspiration has come from. I can't even imagine what it must have been like then taking this body of work and this idea to black female composers and saying, do you want in on this? What was their reaction?
Well, I think they were really, I don't know if excited is the right word, but it gave each of them an opportunity to look at their own histories and to also just honor, I think, histories that they have not felt maybe able to address so explicitly in their work up until this moment. So when it came to Cassie Kinoshi, the newest commission.
And that's who you're working with here in the UK. Yeah.
That's right. And, you know, I am so glad that the Philharmonia brought her work and cast my attention. So anyway, when I shared this project with her, I said, of course, though, everything up until now has been focusing on the United States, but there absolutely should be no denial of Britain's involvement in human trafficking trade across the Atlantic Ocean and start delving into this. And she took the lead. She, I left it to her to find the voice or voices that she wanted to represent or start speaking to the subject matter. And she brought to my attention, very, very happily brought to my attention, Una Marson, who's a poet, activist, feminist, and playwright who I didn't know.
It's going to be an incredible evening. I mean, so powerful just from hearing you speak about it and the collaborations that you've forged. I want to talk a little bit about you and your voice because it's, everyone heard it. It's absolutely sublime. Just such a talent. But you actually started at a young age as a dancer and performing in musical theatre. When did you decide that musical theatre wasn't for you and that you were going to go down the classical route? You were quite young, weren't you?
Well, yeah. I mean, I guess I always knew I wanted to perform. And you're embarrassing me talking about
that. Am I? Sorry. It's okay. No, it's only Woman's Hour. We're they're very nice people who listen to the programme. Don't be embarrassed. We're a little family.
Anyway, I appreciate the compliments either way, so thank you. But yes, I knew I always wanted to perform or at least express myself with my body in one way or another from a really young age. But my stepfather shared his favorite recordings of classical singers, or at least singers who sang classical Western European music. And I was just intuitively drawn to the material in high school. And it just shifted the course of my life, I guess.
And do you find that music and protest or activism work well together? Is it an effective way for you to get your message across?
I think it has always been, the arts in general have always been connected with politics, highly aware of social issues and also just the work of engaging people, helping people to listen to each other. So yes, I do think music is an incredibly powerful tool, not only to help people join in voice together, but again, really to encourage the deepest form of listening.
And I know that to some extent, all women of color who are creating art, you know, it's political. But where does your passion stem from? Why is it so important for you?
I guess just my history, the life that I've led, all the things that I've read and reflected on.
And your father a little bit?
Well, sure. I mean, I'm of mixed, certainly family, yes, had an influence. I'm of a mixed heritage, multi-ethnicity. My mother was white, my dad was black, and he was deeply involved in the civil rights movement. He was the president of SNCC, which was the student organization at Morehouse University, where he went to school. And he did share after a sit-in, he shared a jail cell with Martin Luther King. So, some of my earliest memories of music are of him singing civil rights songs.
He shared a jail cell with Martin Luther King.
He did, I think a lot of people, a lot of people did at that time.
If you were protesting at that time, chances are you're going to be in a jail cell with Dr. Martin Luther King.
Well, at some point.
Julia, it's been such a pleasure speaking to you, and best of luck with the evening. Thank you so much for speaking to me on Woman's Hour this morning.
Truly a pleasure. Thank you.
Julia will be performing History's Persistent Voice at the Queen Elizabeth Hall in London on Friday, the 2nd of February. I think it's going to be quite something. Now, this one really kicked off in Woman's Hour HQ this morning. Do you pay your children to do chores around the house? Well, the journalist Helen Carroll wrote in The Times saying she faced an online backlash when she mentioned in passing that she pays her son £40 a month to empty the dishwasher every day, which she says works out at £1.33 a day to put the dishes away. So do you pay your children to do chores around the house? Or were you, like me and pretty much every other Asian kid growing up in the 80s and 90s, just expected to do the chores as a child as your contribution to the family life and home? So is it ever okay to pay children to do chores? And if you do, how should you do it? Well, to help us navigate this minefield is parenting coach and author of Parenting Made Easy, Sue Atkins. Oh, welcome to Woman's Hour, Sue. Come on, tell us.
Thank you for having me.
It's our pleasure. What should we be doing? First of all, what do you make of the story?
Oh, it's so interesting, isn't it? You know, my mum was the eldest of seven, and my granddad would not be paying the kids to make their bed and brush their teeth and, you know, obviously not empty the dishwasher. We're going back a bit. But for me, it is about the we team, you know, the we family team, like Atkins family team. So you, you know, make your bed, you put your pajamas underneath the pillow, you put your bowl away when you've had your cereal. And I remember when my kids were young, they're grown now. My son had to empty the bin, not one of his favourite things. My daughter had to empty the dishwasher. Then we swapped it around a bit. It's part of responsibility. It's teaching them independence. It's the same thing like with toddlers, you know, put your toys away. It's just what you do to help the family, isn't it?
So you didn't pay your children, but why do some parents choose to pay their children to do chores? I mean, we had a range of opinions in the office, and some do it as an incentive.
Yes, but it becomes transactional. Then they go, no, I'm not going to put that away in the cupboard because how much are you going to pay me? Or I'm not going to tidy that up, you know, what are you going to pay me? I can see it. My own daughter wanted to buy a camera, you know, when we didn't have phones sort of thing being so good then. And my car was never so clean because, of course, she wanted to wash the car to get an extra fiver. And actually, she really looked after that camera and she really took care of, you know, making sure she, you know, had a good time with it because she'd bought into it. I think really, if you're paying them, it means you haven't quite sort of mastered your expectations about why they need to do chores. And I think also then it means that the kids see life as sort of transactional and life isn't sort of like that, really. So I think you've got to be clear in it, why you want to do it, have that chat with them. But a lot of parents want to be their kids' friend and they don't set it up properly, really, in how they sort of suggest it. So you can start very young. I mean, toddlers, let's face it, love to get the Hoover out and do a bit of dusting. Now, I'm not suggesting that you're going to make them do those sorts of chores, but you can see they want to be part of what you're doing. So I think if you have that conversation with them and you set it out, I mean, I've got a blog where I put it at ages and stages, you know, 2 to 3 year olds, as I say, put your toys away, 10 year old, you know, make your bed, bring your washing down, tidy your bowl away after cereal, get your school bag. These are all things that teach responsibility and self-discipline.
Yeah, it sounds great. But what if they don't listen? What if your 10-year-old's just like, not going to do it, sorry?
Yeah, but that's a parenting thing, isn't it? That's because you're not sort of assertive or you don't what I call mean business. You don't have to wait until it becomes a real problem and you've got resentment and you're angry that you're fussing and going around after them all the time, tidying up. But it's getting clear about why you want to do it, being confident in your parenting, having a perhaps a sit down and saying, look, we've got a bit of a problem going on here. I'm running around after you all and I want you to do some jobs. So divvy the jobs out. Don't make it all arduous. Think of it more as sort of helping out rather than making them. Chat with them and thank them when they do it and make it a light sort of hearted touch. But we are the team and we do jobs. You know, my husband empties the bin every Tuesday. It's not one of his life's works. He doesn't love doing it, but he does it.
You got yourself a keeper there, Sue. You got yourself a keeper. Well, look, the messages are going berserk. Loads of people want to share their stories on this. So I'm going to read a few of these out. Everyone in a family should contribute to household chores, respect for others, and importantly, respect for oneself and the spaces we share. Someone else says, I shared a house at university with blokes who had clearly never even boiled an egg before, never mind wash a dish. Shame on their mothers and their fathers. I'll just get out the house and find people who know how to clean. Someone else says, I shared a house at, good morning. In regards to the housework conundrum, at 12, I stood each child in front of the washing machine and said, you are entering the adult world. This device is going to be your friend. From that point, they willingly did their own laundry, including bedding and towels. I gave them the independence. No more, Mom, where's my shirt, trousers, PE kit? They revelled in the agency it gave them, the youngest now 15 and blossoming. Is that how you do it?
Yeah. Isn't that wonderful? You know, that's self-empowering, isn't it? Because let's face it, they're so technically savvy, they can work the dishwasher.
Well, talking of tech, a lot of the banking apps actively encourage sort of paying your children. What do you make of that?
It's a balance, isn't it? Sometimes they put money in, so there's your monthly allowance sort of thing. And that's the difference. I've written about pocket money. That's slightly different, pocket money to doing chores, because then kids learn to sort of, oh, when it's gone, you know. And when you give them pocket money in our house, it was really, you know, they ate loads of sweets and bought comics because that's their money to spend it on. As they get older, and those apps are great, because then you go, well, here's your allowance and this is what you can spend it on in terms of your lunch at school. So you're very clear about how you want them to be able to spend it. So they are actually learning about money and money management, actually, as they get older, aren't they?
As someone else has said here, Izzy says, my 8-year-old daughter created and decorated a table list of chores for the whole family to do each day. I think she could see I was feeling a little overwhelmed by it all. She added her job for today as give hugs.
Oh,
Izzy, she sounds adorable. Another message here. I have involved my son, who is now 4, with chores since he first started to walk. He has a sense of pride and responsibility from being depended on to help with household tasks. And often he's the one to instigate doing things. So he'll do things automatically, like he'll put away his shoes when he gets in from school. He'll hang his coat and hat up, put his plate and bowl in the dishwasher when he's finished. I'm very much looking forward to when he's bigger and able to help out with the mowing of the lawn. Now, reading that, I've been triggered because I would not have been able to get away with just leaving stuff lying around. It just wouldn't have... I mean, it's just... put your shoes away is just a basic.
Yeah. I remember actually when I came home, I was a deputy head for many years and teacher. And I came home, my son had got home earlier, you know, from the school bus, and he was watching the telly with crisp packets everywhere, his shoes and his coat, just, you know, in the sitting room. And it triggered me because I was exhausted being busy all day. And so I, rather than lose the temper and you lose the relationship, I then sort of thought, well, I need to do something about that. So I did one of these, like, you need to come and sit down. We need to have a chat. And then you're clear about what you want. And then it sort of eases the relationship. And then he did put his shoes away and all the rest of it. So, you know, I think it can be done nicely. You don't have to shout and yell at it. But I think expectations are important, because when you go out in the real world, you know, people are not going to tidy up after you, are they, at work?
Very true. So... do you agree then, Sue? We need to your opinion on this. You've already talked about parents being assertive. You don't need to be their friends. But what about this whole, what's the balance between the carrot and the stick when it comes to chores?
That's a good one, isn't it? It's about, if you know your why, and if you think, well, I want to teach them responsibility, independence, being part of a team, and it's good for their self-confidence and their self-esteem because they achieve something and they feel good about that. So if you know your why, then think about how you're going to do it, when you're going to sort of talk to them about it, and then stick to your guns. You know, it's what I call meaning business. It's being an assertive parent, not an angry one, and making sure that you do have to remind them. So I often think, create a poster, stick it up in the kitchen, because then you can remind them that actually, you know, your job this week is to empty the bins or whatever you got to do.
Oh, so this has been so interesting. There might be some kids getting pay cuts after listening to this. Don't think they're going to be very happy. Thank you so much for speaking to us this morning.
Pleasure. Nice to be on. Thanks a lot.
Hilary has emailed to say, children learn by observation and pick up what needs to be done, such as making beds or washing up, without framing things as chores. They will gradually learn what needs to be done in life without turning it into a big thing or turning it into a commercial or punitive exercise. We certainly didn't raise our kids to be skivvies, either paid or unpaid, and they will have their whole adult lives to perform boring domestic jobs on their own behalves. Let's let kids be kids. Keep your thoughts coming in. Now, you might remember on the programme we spoke to Steph Daniels, amazing woman in her 70s who decided to take up hockey again after giving it up in her 30s to become a PE teacher. Here she is telling us what it was that brought her back to hockey.
I saw a picture in the local Bedford paper about walking hockey, and I'd never really heard about walking hockey. And I thought, oh, have I still got my stick? Would it still be the right shape? Could I still play? Would I still have my skills? So I thought I'd go along and see. And so it's a wonderful group. It's a wonderful community of walkers, men, women, all ages. And during the pandemic, it was a lifesaver for all of us because we could play outside, we could have fun, we could have contact with people and get fit. So the physical and mental health of walking hockey was fantastic. But yes, I mean, not everybody's into sport. I mean, you can do music, you can join a choir. I mean, to do a team, something in a team, is so unusual for women. Once you leave school, most women don't ever play in a team again. So to play a team sport or be in an orchestra or a choir or just going down to the gym and being with other people, go for it. There's so many things women can do these days.
That was Steph Daniels, who took up hockey again in her 70s. Just her voice was so energetic and inspiring, wasn't it? And this got us thinking about reigniting old passions. We want to hear from you. I said old passions, not old flames. We want to hear from you. Maybe you thought you'd left. Well, you could reignite an old flame, maybe. That as well. Get in touch with us. If you'd left belly dancing behind but now spend Thursdays shimmying in the sports hall, we want to hear from you. If you packed away the power tools but a tempting project called you out to say, dust off the power tool. Maybe you've spritzed up some old recipes and become a gourmet chef. We want to hear about it all. Get in touch in the usual way. Text us on 84844. Drop us a note via social media at BBC Woman's Hour. And of course, you can email us through the website. We'd love to feature your stories in a new series. So let us know what it is you've picked up again. So many messages still coming through about chores. Oh, chores, such a trigger, might have to turn off. Kids should do chores. I'm rubbish at this parenting lark. And as a much older mother, I'd rather not waste my energy and years arguing with my sons. And someone else, Mary, says, hi, Woman's Hour. We had two levels of money for our four boys. Chores were paid for. If they didn't do it, they didn't get paid. Conditional pay. Number two, pocket money always given each week and was unconditional. This strategy we adopted from a wonderful book called Happy Children. It talked about license versus responsibility. Very enlightening. And I am a grandmother now, so I'm going back many years. Thank you for that, Mary. On to my next guest. It's time to take a dive into the world of the supernatural, but with an unexpected twist. Witches and the modern dating scene. Coming your way on January the 31st is a new drama on BBC Three called Domino Day. It's all about a group of witches in modern day Manchester. The creative genius behind this series is Lauren Sequeira, whose series The Dumping Ground was nominated for a BAFTA. And I'm delighted to say that Lauren is here.
Hi.
Welcome to Woman's Hour.
Thanks for having me.
It is my absolute pleasure. Congratulations.
Thank you.
First original series for the BBC. What an achievement. I watched the first episode last night. It's right up my street.
Oh,
absolutely
insane. Got a fan here.
You have?
Yeah.
Domino Day, that's the name of the main character. Tell us what it's all about.
Yeah, so Domino Day is a very powerful witch who is haunted by her need to feed on the energy of others. So she goes on the apps, she swipes, finds a prey, feeds from them, and then blocks them and moves on. But she's unaware that a coven of witches are following her every move and are convinced they need to stop her. Yes, juicy stuff.
Juicy stuff. Why witches? Where did the idea come from?
I mean, I love the supernatural. I watch all those shows like Buffy, True Blood, The Vampire Diaries, and I think the Americans, they just do it so well and all the time. And I just really wanted to write a UK-based supernatural drama, but also looked at real world relationships and how we connect to each other and the app culture.
And you have placed women of colour, black women, in this genre.
Yes.
Well, look at you.
It was like the biggest priority. Like the three strongest witches in the show are all black women. And I'm so proud of their performances as well.
Yeah, the performances are amazing. I mean, it's an obvious question, but why was it so important to
being a black woman myself and just the supernatural dramas that are out there, like they're never in the leading roles, you know, and it was just really important to me to sort of show that representation.
We've just heard from the amazing 70-year-old hockey player talking about women getting into teams and the camaraderie and what that can do for you. What was this project like working on it? And what was it like behind the camera and in front of camera? What was that feeling like?
I sort of treated it like this is my coven. So it's sort of the themes of the show I tried to put behind the show. Like we got female writers and we got female directors, and it was really important to sort of centre that female experience of dating and relationships at the centre of this project.
Yeah, yes. So you focus on the modern day dating scene. Why did you want to put that in the heart of it?
I mean, I'm in it.
She's in it.
I've got so many experiences, and it's just like how most people date now. And, you know, it has its pros and its cons. And I really wanted to show how it could be used by this supernatural creature to sort of find prey.
So in the first episode, and it's not a spoiler, because this is only the first episode,
Jason.
Oh, I was actually shouting at the screen when he ordered her drink for
yes,
her.
Yes, red wine.
He's never even met her before, and he just come on, like why? Just walk away. But then she finds. I mean, he basically attempts to rape her, mm-hmm. and he's unbeknownst to her, he's filming the experience.
Yes. Yeah.
I read that when you were in the sixth form, there was a guy at your school who used to film
yes.
girls.
Yeah.
And is that why that detail went in the show? Yeah. And how much of this is based on your own experience?
Absolutely. I mean, yeah, that guy, back when obviously we were 16, and it was sort of before a lot of social media became prevalent, like the TikTok and the Instagram. But the fact that he did that, and it was my boyfriend at the time, told me about it. I think he tried to show, and it was just awful. I was just flabbergasted. So, and it's always stayed with me. So, yeah, in the first 10 minutes of the first episode, I really wanted to explore that, but flip it and make who he thinks is the victim become the powerful one and take advantage.
It's terrifying. I mean, I don't know whether you're listening to the beginning of the programme, but we were talking about a lot of research that's been done into misconceptions around rape. And the younger generation, 18 to 24-year-olds, hold more misconceptions and think truths are truths than older generations. Mm. I just wondered what your take on that might be.
Yeah, I mean, the word consent, I don't think it's still understood. So the fact that Domino goes back home with this guy, it's like he's taken that as consent in a way, like, you know, I can do whatever I want with you. And that's like wrong, you know, and that's why I wanted to make him the victim in the end. And so, and that's the moment where the supernatural world is sort of announced as well. But yeah, no, it's a big problem with society at the moment. And yeah, it needs to be talked about more.
And doing what you do, creating art.
Yeah, points.
Absolutely. Yeah. I love the female friendships and women supporting women in this series as well. So I think we should hear a clip of when Sammy meets Domino. Tell us who Sammy is.
Sammy is an empath witch. She's the first one that notices Domino, and she can sort of read her aura and can tell that she's sort of struggling with what she's having to do with the whole feeding. So
this is when Sammy meets Domino.
We've been watching you.
We?
Hi, Coven. We want to understand you.
Okay. You better get in line by me. What did you learn?
That you're doing something to humans.
Oh, God.
Right, but you don't want to be. Your whole aura is full of conflict. I know it must be hard, but you can talk to me.
It's beautiful, just that bit. It's about Domino on a journey of self-discovery, isn't it?
Yeah, and just needing to find a community, a sisterhood to sort of help. Like, that for me is like the most important thing that any woman can have in life. It's not so much the romantic relationships, it is that sisterhood, you know.
Who's in your sisterhood?
Oh, my friend Romina. I've got lots of people around me, lots of strong black women as well, that like parts of their characters I've put, parts of their personalities I've put in the characters.
Have they watched it with you and tried to guess?
Not yet. No, I haven't shared it actually.
Why is it important to have that community of black women around you?
Because I just don't think we see it often. Mm. And, you know, as black women, there's so many obstacles, hidden obstacles that we have to like deal with every day. And it's that sisterhood, you know, sharing our experiences with each other, you know, whether we're fetishized on the dating scene or something. You know, I had to put that in the first episode as well.
Oh, yeah, her skin.
Yes, I've had that.
Oh, yeah.
To me.
Oh, no. Yeah. I've had this as well. I don't normally fancy black women.
Yeah, but that's in episode two.
Oh, yeah. Oh, okay. Maybe I did watch more than one episode. Maybe I started binging it. Yeah.
Yeah. So it's just, you know, those experiences, you sort of need that sisterhood to just navigate it and, you know, work through it emotionally with each other.
So, and, you know, I fully understand that it's hard and, life experience is different when you're a woman of colour. So I want to talk about how you've attained your incredible success as well, because to be sitting here talking about your series on the BBC.
No.
I know, it's an incredible achievement. But you have written for other TV shows. I mentioned The Dumping Ground that was nominated for a BAFTA.
Yeah.
You also wrote an episode for the series Gangs of London, heavily focused on male violence against women. What was it like writing that?
I mean, the team behind it were so, like, amazing and grounded. And, yeah, I mean, as it's a very male show. There's a lot of male characters. And in the particular episode I was given, you know, there is a woman who is being tortured. And it was, I had to go to dark places to get there, I must admit. But I just think in terms of like what the show gave people at the time in the pandemic, it was, I don't know, it just, it was an adrenaline, a bolt of adrenaline that people needed, I guess.
And did you see a difference in the phone calls you were getting and the emails you were receiving once you got your BAFTA nomination?
Oh, yeah, yeah. But I'm very, like, particular about what I take on. I just really, I don't want to be typecast, and it's got to resonate with me somehow.
So how do you find that you're in a position where you can say the very powerful word, no?
I mean, my agent, it's just like reason it out with my agent. And yeah, it's got to speak. Like, I've got to be able to emotionally sit in what the story is saying and find a way to bring some of my own experiences in. Because once I can do that, it feels real. It feels authentic to me.
And now you're in this incredible position where you have a seat at the table and you can turn work down if you don't want.
Yeah. It's still weird when you do it. You're always like, oh, is this the right decision? But yeah.
And you're still at the beginning of your career, even though you've got such huge success. So obviously writing more, what's your plan to go forward? Like, what else would you like to do apart from telling stories and reframing them and having women of colour in there? What more?
I'd love to get on the property ladder.
Good. Very good.
It's the millennial problem.
In terms of the industry?
In the industry. I mean, I just really still want to tell stories, really authored stories. I'd love to tell more supernatural drama as well and just really showcase that the UK can do it just as well as the Americans and that we have things to say about our own.
Why do you think, it often comes up where people talk about how Americans do things not better, differently. Why do you think that is?
I think it's just the sheer scale of the country. It's you know, their budgets and everything. I just think the audience is just bigger for like genre shows over there. You're going into the millions, but there's always an audience for it. You know, YA books, you know, always that are supernatural focus, always have that audience.
I mean, always been obsessed with witches, but yeah. Who have a dirty name.
Yeah.
We are reclaiming that.
Yeah, yeah.
We've been talking about chores and whether or not, I mean, you should be paying your children to do them. Were you made to do them at home? Were you paid to do them?
I was, yeah.
You were paid?
£5, I remember. It was like...
To do what?
Hoover and the dishes, yeah.
Very good.
Yeah.
I was given nothing.
Oh.
Absolutely nothing. I think I actually came home and said, oh, Sally gets a quid to clean the car. And my dad just laughed and walked away.
Oh, I was never asked to clean the car, actually. No. I wasn't trusted.
It's been an absolute joy speaking to you.
Oh, thank you for
having
me.
I want to wish you the best of luck with the series. I might have already binge-watched it. thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Door open for you anytime you want to come back and speak to
thank
us.
You.
Thanks to all of you for getting in touch. Another message here. Some 20 years ago, I had two of my kids and two stepkids in a large house. They got £5 a week while they were in our house. That was pocket money, but they needed to keep rooms clean, tidy up, and they had a rota for all the housework. So no arguing. It was fair. It was a work ethic thing. I'm Graham. Thank you, Graham. Join me tomorrow for Weekend Woman's Hour, where we'll be hearing from rapper Princess Superstar, who's had a big hit at the age of 52. Her song Perfect features in the film Saltburn. See you then.
That's all for today's Woman's Hour. Join us again next time.
30 years ago, Britain's farms were hit by an epidemic of an infectious brain disorder. They called it mad cow disease. I'm Lucy Proctor, and in The Cows Are Mad from BBC Radio 4, I tell the story of a very weird time in our history.
The media started calling me the mad cow professor.
Mad cow disease rampaged through Britain, first killing cows and then humans. And the thing is, after all this time, nobody knows for sure where mad cow disease originally came from.
And the general feeling is that we will never know the answer.
Subscribe to The Cows Are Mad on BBC Sounds.
Why don't more infant formula companies use organic, grass-fed whole milk instead of skim? Why don't more infant formula companies use the latest breast milk science? Why don't more infant formula companies run their own clinical trials? Why don't more infant formula companies use more of the proteins found in breast milk? Why don't more infant formula companies have their own factories instead of outsourcing their manufacturing? We wondered the same thing. So we made ByHeart, a better formula for formula. Learn more at ByHeart.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.